In the intricate world of Korean affairs, tailored intelligence makes all the difference. Korea Risk Group's consulting services offer specialized, actionable intelligence designed to guide your career-related decisions. We provide bespoke consulting services that cater to your unique challenges and goals. From policy analysis to market entry strategies, we bring clarity to complexity. Transform uncertainty into opportunity and visit careerpro.com solutions today. Listeners, and welcome to the NK News podcast. And this pre-interview interview is recorded on Tuesday, the 13th of February, 2024. And I'm here in the NK News studio with Anton Sokolin. Anton, welcome back on the show.
Hey, Jaco, how are you doing?
And they're videoing us now. This is a new
thing.
Wow. I know. Some of our video banter may end up on the interwebs.
Oh, geez, I gotta wave to my mom. If she's watching, I don't know.
You send her the link and make sure she watches it. Yeah. Okay, so what would you like to talk about today?
Well, we had a few interesting developments on the Korean Peninsula. Well, the Korean Peninsula never stops surprising you.
That's right.
So what we've got here, there was this new, let's say, rocketry development. North Korea tested a new controlled rocket artillery shell and ballistic control system.
Hang on. A new artillery rocket shell and what?
Controlled rocket artillery shell and ballistic control system. How about that?
Okay, now normally when I think, I'm not a weapons expert by any means, as our listeners will know. When I think of artillery, I think of something being shot out of a shell, like a cannon, and then it goes up and then it comes down. But then a rocket, it has a propulsion system of its own, and it may even be able to be steered or guided once it's shot. So what are we doing here? We've got artillery and rockets together?
So I suppose, yes, it's modification, right, that basically allows you to guide your projectiles.
Okay.
And it has caliber of 240 millimeters, so it's pretty big one.
Yeah. And that's 24 centimeters, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, 24 centimeters, of course, yeah. I mean, it's pretty large. You can also compare it to other shells that North Korea uses. Like, for example, those that frequently end up in Ukraine, they are usually like 152 or like, 120 or something like that.
Millimeters.
Yeah, millimeters.
So they're smaller than the one we're talking about.
Okay. But of course, they are produced on a much more larger scale, so there's more of them. So when we talk about this multiple rocket launcher system, it's that obviously it's a new development, it's a new addition to North Korea's arsenal of new things, and of course it sort of can pose danger, but we should never forget that North Korea has a very extensive arsenal of those artillery shells that can literally threaten its neighbors. Well, in our particular case, it's South Korea.
Right, and they sometimes like to remind us that they can turn Seoul into a sea of fire if they let go of all of their artillery shells at once.
Right, and of course, it's important to remember that, while we talk about these things, it's important not to get ahead of ourselves and not to be paranoid, right?
Right.
Because South Korea also can respond to this, and my colleague Shreyas, who wrote an article about this rocket launcher system, he also talked to a few experts who explained the significance of this development and what South Korea can do. And it is interesting because the experts are saying that while this system represents a new development, it also comes in like it's another milestone, another step in the whole progress of North Korea's development of these missiles. And when we talk about South Korea, what it can do to respond to this? Well, it's a very interesting question because you see, whenever South Korea wants to respond to North Korea's new rocketry developments, North Korea would see it as another escalation, right?
Mm.
So whenever South Korea increases its military budget or it wants to invest in certain things, it will trigger another response from North Korea,
right,
and the vicious circle will continue. So we need to keep in mind that that it's a very minor development and a whole in the grand scheme of things, but it's quite notable because it definitely attracts a lot of attention, and definitely it can play a certain role in increasing escalation on the Korean Peninsula.
Yeah. Now, has North Korea been test firing this new system in the direction of South Korea or towards the sea?
Actually, you know, it's very interesting because as it often goes with North Korea, these sort of announcements of these weaponry tests, they are usually very scant. So there is not much information. We don't really know much. I don't think it was directly fired at South Korea, but who knows? At least we haven't heard anything from the South Korean military when it happened. We only know about it from North Korea state media.
Okay.
So it leaves this room to interpretation, you know.
Right. But generally, when things are fired in the direction of South Korea, the Joint Chiefs of Staff say something or release a statement or... and call it a provocation. So in
exactly.
this case, it looks like they haven't done that yet.
Exactly, as it was the case with those multiple cruise missiles that North Korea launched over the few months. Like there were four instances of those launches. And every time the JCS and even Japan, JCS in this case, it's only JCS, they would confirm the launch and they would at least provide at least some more information on the direction, location, and all those things.
Okay, so we have a new... weapons and control system created by North Korea that...
Let's not call it new because it's been there, but because it's been around. They have been working on it before, but let's call it a new modification. Maybe it's a new development stage.
So it's improved.
It's improved.
Okay, the improved model.
Yeah.
Mm, okay. Now, when you were last on the podcast, which was only a week ago, it was not that long ago.
Right, I see you very often these days.
Yeah, we had the round table and we talked about Russian tourists, about 100 of them, going back into North Korea, the first tour group since late 2019. So it's a big step for North Korea. Have they been posting on social media?
Actually, yes. As you know, by now they have returned. And
how long were they there? Was it just a week or two?
So it's it's been just 4 days, nights. So it's a very short pilot tour, as what they call it.
Yeah.
And they have just returned. The response is generally very good, actually. At least those interviews that Russian state media released. And
Russian state media has covered this?
Yes, afterwards when they returned.
Yep.
Because obviously, I suppose they couldn't upload anything to the internet because of the lack of internet connection in North Korea.
Or the expense, or both.
Or the expense, because of course you can... get actually a certain access, but the speed will be extremely low.
Right.
And it will be limited. So.
And it's not good for 1 megabyte, 2 megabyte photographs.
Absolutely, no. And if we are talking about videos, it's close to impossible.
Yeah.
So from the videos that I've seen, we can conclude that people are generally happy. The tourists look very content. And some of them shared their experiences saying that it gives them this nostalgic vibe of something that they're used to be familiar during their Soviet days.
Now, anyone who's directly experiencing nostalgia must be more than, let's say, 40 years or older. But I think I saw some photographs of some youngish-looking Russians there too, right?
Right.
So what is it? What's in it for them?
Well, there were a few teenagers that went to North Korea. I know that they are part of some winter sports team that regularly train in the Russian region of Primorsky Krai, which means that they travel to this specific ski resort, the Masignon ski resort, to train, to just try the slopes and everything. So for them, I suppose it was nothing more than just going to another ski resort to just do snowboarding or whatever they do.
Do we know anything about the quality of snow there at the Masignon? Is it all? Is it good? Is it natural? Is it powdery? Is it wet?
It's a good question. I know that they have artificial snow as well, but this time of the year, it appears to be pretty good for winter activities. So they have a generous amount of snow at this point. And again, the tourists, they shared their thoughts on this. They said that everything is great. Like the length of the slopes is great. The angle, the quality of the facilities and everything. So it seems like the North Koreans did a pretty good job maintaining, building at first and then maintaining the facility. So it looks like a very nice place to go. At the same time, of course, we can also balance this with a bit of grain of salt saying that, well, if you want to go to a ski resort, do you really need to go to North Korea, all the way to North Korea, when you have those same resorts in Russia? Russia has plenty of mountains.
Yeah, yeah. And snow.
And snow,
in Siberia.
Absolutely.
Yeah. It's a good question. And of course, one of the concerns I've read about over the years is that if you were to injure yourself while skiing in Masignon, maybe break a leg or something, it could be difficult to get to good medical facilities, in a speedy way. And even, it could be better to be in Russia in that situation.
Right. Actually, it's a very good question. But as far as I remember, of course, every Russian tourist that went on this trip, of course, had a medical insurance.
Right.
It was included.
Hopefully Medivac insurance as
well.
Well, just in case.
I'm not sure if they would use any helicopter to just move you around. But I'm sure the North Korean side thoroughly prepared for it. So if, in case of any emergencies, they would just fly you to Pyongyang or whatever and then quickly to Vladivostok. It's just a matter of 1 or 2 hours. So it's pretty much doable.
Right.
So, yeah.
Well, I hope so. I recall somebody injuring themselves during the marathon at the Pyongyang Marathon in 2019, and the medical care there was, let's just say, inadequate.
Well, I also heard of less than substandard medical care services in North Korea. When just a recollection of someone else is saying that,
right.
Maybe actually you need to look at my article, a recent article, this interview I had with a Russian guy who went to North Korea.
I did. I read that this morning. That was actually a fun article. People should definitely go and read that about a young man who went to, 2015, 2016, or 2017? So in the mid 2010s, he went to two North Korean camps.
Well, he went to the same one twice.
Oh, that's a big pardon. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. So one year and then the next year.
Yes, exactly. Precisely. And he also had some interesting experience with the North Korean medical system.
Right.
When there was this nurse that dropped a mercury
thermometer.
Thermometer and just it broke, it shattered.
Yeah.
And according to him, she just picked it up and just tossed in the trash bin right next to her as if it was nothing, not even the mercury. He freaked out because obviously, as a Russian fellow, I think we are taught at school that whenever this happens, you gotta kind of take cover, escape, or don't touch this thing. And yeah, there is plenty of those anecdotes about North Korean medical system. Well...
Okay, well, we got time for one more quick story. What else have you got for us, Anton?
I haven't got anything for you right now. I can only maybe go on about Russia. For example, this Russian ambassador to North Korea had also said a few things. Russia is practically planning to expand its logistical cooperation with North Korea, transportation cooperation, let's call it like that, by building this new car bridge. So you might remember there has been a lot of talk about car bridge, highway bridge that would connect the Russian region of Primorsky Krai and Rason Rajin, that area, but it's never really materialized so far. But this time seems like it's going to happen, and the ambassador hinted that there will be an agreement probably signed by Vladimir Putin when he actually visits North Korea. His visit is confirmed, but we don't know when exactly.
Ah.
We don't know the dates. So let's just keep an eye on it.
It could be one of those things that is only reported about after the fact by Russian and North Korean state media.
I think something will leak at some point. At some point, we will know.
Mm-hmm.
And they might announce it just last minute.
Yep.
Like, oh, he just arrived or something like that.
Right.
That is possible. They will hold off this information till the very last moment. But still, it's confirmed. Russia and North Korea are ushering into this new age of transportation cooperation. Of course, ferry lines. They are also thinking about expanding a railroad connectivity. Which is very difficult because North Korean railroad infrastructure is pretty outdated, and connecting it with the Russian one will be pretty difficult. Also, we need to consider the gauge and everything. So it adds a bit of complexity to this issue. But yeah, that's what we know for now, and we will see how this whole situation pans out.
Okay, well, my little piece of Russian Korea trivia for you is that 2 days ago, on Sunday, the 11th of February, it was exactly 128 years to the day after King Kojong and his son Prince Sunjong were secretly removed from Gyeongbuk Palace to the Russian legation in Jeongdong, and they lived there in a kind of exile, like Julian Assange, for 1 year. While waiting for the construction of the new palace at Doksugung. So,
right, it's called Rogwan Pachon.
Agwan Pachon.
Agwan Pachon.
Yeah, which
at that time, Ro, yeah.
Yeah, right. Ah from Maybe Roshia, I guess. Or
Arasa.
Arasa. But they got that from either the Mongols or the Manchus, who put A in front of
it. Exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
Absolutely. Oh, that's a nice one. And that's a nice anecdote. Actually, I completely missed it. Thanks for bringing it up.
Well, 2 years from now, it'll be the 130th anniversary. And I have a dream to open a Korean pajeon restaurant. And I'd like to call it a Agwon Pajeon. Rather than Agwon Pachon, that's...
That makes sense. Yeah. That would be a nice one.
And I would like pancakes. To open it right next to the old Russian legation tower in Jeongdong. You know, would
well, thematically you're going to be... Your business is going to just boom completely. It will just knock people's socks off.
Okay, yeah, that's right. All right, listeners, that's it for our pre-interview chat. Stay tuned, because after the break, you'll hear my long interview with Scott Snyder of the Council on Foreign Relations. Thanks for listening, and thanks for coming on the show, Anton.
Thank you, Jacko.
See you again next time. Get to the core of Korean insights with KoreaPro's exclusive Seoul event series. Join us for gatherings that bring you face-to-face with key opinion leaders, journalists, and experts on South Korean affairs for dinner, drinks, and more. Engage in deep discussions on political, economic, and social issues at special venues across Seoul. From dinners with KoreaPro editors to insightful conversations with renowned guests, each event promises a unique blend of expertise and networking. Immerse yourself in the pulse of Korea. Register now at events.koreapro.org. My guest today is Scott Snyder. For a little longer, he is Senior Fellow for Korea Studies and Director of the Program on U.S.-Korea Policy at the Council of Foreign Relations. But on April 1st, he'll become the new President and Chief Executive Officer of the Korea Economic Institute of America. Scott has written or edited or co-written more books than I have read last year. Listeners can find Scott on Twitter at Snyder, S-A-S, and we'll put a link to that in the show notes. Welcome on the show, Scott.
Thank you, Jacko. It's great to have a chance to talk to you.
It's great to have you here. Now, you've worked for quite some time at the Council on Foreign Relations, which some people see as a shadowy cabal of influential, unelected people who shape world affairs. Is that a fair characterization?
I would say that our influence is a little bit more limited than that.
What is it, actually? What is the CFR and what does it do?
Well, I think that maybe one reason why that impression exists is that it is a membership organization. So there are about 5,000 members, about a third in New York, third in the D.C. area, and a third national in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And we do have the good fortune of hosting a number of world leaders for various types of speeches, especially around the UN General Assembly, because a lot of people are visiting New York at that time. And then we're also the publisher of Foreign Affairs, which is, I think, the flagship publication and, you know, really a very prominent publication in the international relations arena.
Indeed.
But probably the reason, I mean, the function that I'm most familiar with is that essentially, even though the council is a membership organization, it essentially has its own think tank, studies department, of which I'm a part. And we just cover almost all parts of the world from various perspectives through our scores of researchers who are looking at specific issues around the world.
Right. Does the CFR put out policy advice and do governments listen to it?
It certainly does try to put out recommendations. We're very active in trying to make recommendations, but they're individual recommendations by the scholars themselves rather than policy positions of the institution. And I don't know, everybody wants to think that their advice is the best and that it's being listened to.
Yes.
I would say that I feel I personally have a mixed record in terms of, I have a very full record in terms of providing advice, but I have a mixed record in terms of getting people to actually follow my advice.
Ah, and so tell us a little bit about your role there. What have you been doing?
Well, I'm the Senior Fellow for Korea Studies at the Council. I've been at CFR for about 12 years, was previously adjunct for about 3 years. So my association with the Council goes back now about 15 years. And while I've been there, I've done a lot of work on, in particular, the U.S.-South Korea relationship. And I have been following North Korea during that time. And U.S.-North Korea relations, the inter-Korean relationship, Basically, I've been looking at Korea and the region and have paid special attention to the foreign policies of the two Koreas and have been essentially on call to write about various issues and events, and basically both to provide context for media, but also to try to analyze and make my best assessment as regards current issues and how the relationships might develop in the future.
Right. And you have written a lot. You are quite prolific. And your latest book that we're going to talk a bit about today is called The United States-South Korea Alliance, Why It May Fail and Why It Must Not. So it's a very clear title in that it predicts what kind of content the book has inside it. So I want to deal with these questions in reverse order. First of all, why must the ROK-US alliance not fail?
Well, my argument is essentially that the alliance serves the shared interests of both the U.S. and South Korea, and that those interests are vital to the national security of each country.
Okay, so from both countries' perspectives, you're saying it's something that must not fail. It really benefits both. Does it benefit both equally?
Well, I would say that the assessments of who gets more benefit have probably waxed and waned over the course of the history of the relationship. But I would say actually that at this moment, the U.S.-South Korea relationship is probably closer to mutuality than it really ever has been in the 70-year history of the relationship.
That's very interesting. Now, I could see from the Korean perspective that the alliance has a value in that it's deterring aggression by North Korea. But what is its value to the United States?
Yeah, you're right that for a long time, it basically was a one-way security commitment to protect South Korea from the United States. But I think that what is really interesting that has developed, especially over the last couple of years, is the economic dimension of the relationship, and in particular, the flow of South Korean investment into the United States, which provides an economic component to the relationship. It broadens prospects for cooperation to include both economics and security. And then alongside that, we also see a whole host of areas where the two countries are able to work together for the common good in cutting edge areas, technology development, international development assistance, global public health, and even space cooperation. So it's really become a very multifaceted relationship.
Now, that's interesting, but most people, when they think of the word a military alliance, they wouldn't think of these things, right? The economic ties, the global health cooperation, space cooperation. And if I'm not mistaken, these things are not actually spelled out in the alliance. So why do you tie them to the alliance?
Well, I think that they have become a part of the relationship, and more broadly speaking, well, they really are a part of the alliance as the alliance has broadened the depth and scope of its focus. And so one way of describing this is that, for a long time, the alliance was very much focused on the security balance on the Korean Peninsula and on deterring North Korea. But especially since 2009, the moment when the U.S. and South Korea both signed on to a joint vision statement, I think we've seen the alliance deepen and broaden to the point where it has a global role. The alliance is active, for instance, in the context of the war in Ukraine. It has been active in the past, for instance, in dealing with the Ebola outbreak, where the U.S. and South Korea worked together. Increasingly, we see the development agencies of the U.S. and South Korea trying to sync up with each other and work together in Southeast Asia, for instance, really in the context of an investment and infrastructure competition between the U.S. and China. So it's really, I think, just burdened and broadened in terms of its scope.
Right. So you're looking, at a much broader relationship, not just something based on security concerns, but is it based on shared interests and values? Is that what brings the two nations together?
Yeah, I think certainly shared interests. South Korea has such a dependence on foreign trade that it really also has an interest in promoting global stability. And, the unwritten assumption is that a lot of that stability is in the context of a U.S.-led order. And so we find the U.S. and South Korea working together to try to provide public goods in areas where there are threats to international security.
Now, George Washington and other voices throughout U.S. history have argued against permanent alliances and against involvement in the politics of other nations beyond strictly commercial ties. Is this idea that the U.S.-South Korea alliance must not fail against that idea of opposing or avoiding permanent alliances and entanglements?
Well, that's an interesting observation. And I do think that it would be fascinating to hear what George Washington might say about the alliance network and architecture. You know, that's really a creation of the post-World War II international system. Both the U.S.-South Korea Defense Treaty and the U.S.-Japan Alliance are part of that U.S.-led architecture. And, you know, during that period, at least, I think that we can see that it was a world order that was not necessarily following the advice of the founding fathers necessarily, but at the same time, the U.S. played a role that was important in terms of providing space and stability across both in Europe and in Asia, and enabling economic growth.
Sort of Pax Americana idea.
I think that during the Cold War, yes, for those areas where the U.S. was able to project influence, in fact, what we also see is a tamping down of possible regional conflicts that might have reemerged in order to threaten the peace in both regions.
So sort of a general deterrence against adventurism.
Yeah, I think that that is a safe characterization, especially for the Cold War and for most of the post-Cold War.
Now, you said a short time ago that the U.S.-Korea alliance, as it is at the moment, is much closer to a mutually beneficial relationship than it was in the past. That seems to suggest that both sides benefit more or less equally, but which side would have more to lose if the alliance failed or were to be done away with?
I believe that South Korea has more to lose simply because it's in a more complicated regional security environment than the United States. But I also believe that the United States would face losses if the alliance were to be dissolved or degraded. You know, I explore that in the book to some degree. I try to imagine what U.S. foreign policy in Asia would look like without the U.S.-Korea alliance. And I do the same with South Korea. What would South Korean foreign policy look like without the alliance? And for the United States, I think that what it would mean is that the United States would be depending on Japan alone as the vehicle for projecting a forward presence. And that on that particular foundation, its ability to counter influence, in particular from China, would be lessened. And I think that there would possibly be a greater likelihood of tension and conflict between the U.S. and China and between Japan and China in that context. And for South Korea, you know, South Korea is in a funny position because it's the 10th largest economy in the world, but it's in between the second and third largest economies. And so that means that it's still relatively less powerful than its immediate neighbors. And so I think that that does still generate risks. In particular, it makes South Korea's international position in its own region contingent on the policies of neighbors. Fully control or determine the course of events in its own immediate region. And in fact, I think that's one of the really interesting paradoxes that South Korea has faced in conducting its foreign policy in recent years. You know, we see South Korea projecting a lot of soft power and having a lot of influence on non-traditional security in other regions, but it still struggles in terms of being able to control its own destiny or even controlling peace and security on the peninsula.
And to that point of controlling its own destiny, there have been constant criticisms that South Korea, because it is the weaker partner in the alliance with the United States, does not have full agency to think, choose, and act for itself, that the U.S. constrains Korea in its choices and actions. Is that a fair assessment?
Well, it's not that there isn't a point there, but I think that increasingly we see a space where that assertion might be true narrowing. And the area where I would say that it is still clear and present, and the area that remains sensitive and contested, is really related to the issue of nuclear response and the issue of nuclear sovereignty, if you will. And, you know, on that issue, even though last spring we saw a Washington declaration, we saw the establishment of a nuclear consultative group between the U.S. and South Korea, and we see the U.S. and South Korea working together on nuclear planning to counter North Korea's nuclear threat. Essentially, the U.S. still is controlling the decision and the execution of any possible response. And I think that the concerns about that and the evidence that that area of unevenness or inequity is a sticking point lies with the South Korean public opinion about nuclear acquisition and the debate within South Korea about whether it needs to have a nuclear capability, essentially to bring parity to the peninsular balance on the nuclear front.
But what about the criticism that during, for example, most recently during the administration of President Moon Jae-in, that South Korea in its relationship with North Korea wanted to try some things, but was restrained in that by its alliance with America?
Yeah, I look at that in the book. I spend a fair amount of time trying to dig into the various ideological combinations informing leadership in the United States and South Korea.
Yeah.
You know, it's a 2x2 matrix, basically Republicans and Democrats and conservatives and progressives.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I also talk about the impact of domestic political polarization in both countries, especially if married to the influence of exclusive nationalism. And so on the U.S. side, the way that manifests is with America first.
Mm-hmm.
During the Moon administration, although I think the Moon administration itself conducted a foreign policy that was pro-alliance, within the Moon administration, there were various voices that I think could be categorized as quote-unquote North Korea first voices.
Mm-hmm.
That would put a focus on reconciliation with North Korea above the alliance interest. And so, in fact, that is one of the reasons why I wrote the book, was to expose the fact that even though the two countries work together and plan for external threats, you know, there's no planning for the threat from within on either side that comes from the desire of a nationalist leadership to put its own interests above the shared interests in the relationship. And so that's really the critical argument within the book.
I'm wondering, could you think of any examples of situations where South Korea said no to the U.S. or pushed back against its proposals or restraints, for example, in inter-Korean relations or in regional foreign affairs?
Well, we certainly have seen tensions at various times over how to deal with North Korea, for instance. I mean, I think that within the context of cooperating in the alliance relationship, there were differences on priority and differences on direction related to policy toward North Korea. I actually think that the best example in recent Korean history really came during the Nomu-hyun and Bush administration period.
Mm-hmm.
At which time the Nomu-hyun administration, I think, you know, debated options on sovereignty, but also came to the conclusion that its interests lay with maintaining the alliance, despite its desire to take greater ownership and direction, again, focused on the prospect of inter-Korean reconciliation.
Mm. Now, when you talk about the U.S.-South Korea alliance in the era of a nuclear-armed North Korea with ICBM capabilities, one of the issues that gets raised, one of the questions that gets raised, is whether the U.S. may have to choose to sacrifice one of its cities to protect Seoul. And I wonder, what do you think about that? And is that a sacrifice that Americans know they may have to make and are willing to do so outside of D.C.?
Well, it's ironic, isn't it, that North Korea's expansion of its threat to extend to the United States means that the U.S. is facing the same threat from North Korea that South Koreans are facing. On a regular basis. And yet somehow the extension of that threat to a situation where both sides of the alliance are sharing that risk with greater equivalency is generating a set of arguments that could actually push them apart.
Mm.
You know, that's very interesting. I would say outside of Washington, certainly the citizens of Hawaii were made aware of some of the risks that might occur, you know, back during the Fire and Fury period when their cell phones were all buzzing
right.
With information that there might be a North Korean missile headed their way. But overall, I would say that the level of understanding regarding the specifics of the threat from North Korea, you know, it's mixed in the United States among the public. We did see evidence, broadly speaking, of U.S. support for South Korea, and that tends to increase when North Korea is in the news as a threat, and it decreases when North Korea is out of the news as a threat.
Right.
And I do believe that as the U.S. has experienced and debates about its role in the world and about retrenchment, there are more arguments of the sort that even President Trump himself made that, well, you know, the Korean conflict is over there.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, the premise underlying the alliance is actually that security is universal. And I think that that is a premise that both President Biden and President Yoon have been very explicit in acknowledging. So at this moment, under this leadership, the two leaders are in sync. But, you know, with the America First doctrine or idea, it raises more questions about whether, and it will actually, I think, you know, depending on what happens in the future, if we see a future America First leadership in Washington, you know, that will, I think, spike South Korean concerns about credibility of U.S. commitments.
So
that's another reason why I'm underscoring the fragility of the alliance, even though at this particular moment, for all intents and purposes, it looks pretty robust.
Right. So we've just talked about why you think the alliance must not fail, and now we're segueing into why the alliance may fail, and you're pointing to its fragility. Do you think that it's more fragile now than it was, say, just about 20 years ago during the Norman Hyun, George W. Bush era?
Well, the formula that generates a sense of fragility is one in which an America First policy runs up against a Korea First policy of one sort or another.
Right.
And I talked a little bit about the progressive side. On the conservative side, I think that the issue of nuclear sovereignty really is kind of the sticking point issue, where South Korean conservatives might think, if they really doubted the credibility of U.S. willingness to intervene, you know, that would potentially generate great frictions in the relationship between the two sides. So another way of putting it is that America First leadership could actually generate precisely the anxieties that would play into the hands of those on the conservative side who may want to push for a nuclear capability. You know, to a certain extent, President Trump in his first campaign, you know, indicated, well, maybe South Korea should go nuclear. But I don't think it would be quite as easy as that. I think that the decision for South Korea to go nuclear would still generate frictions in the alliance that would be pretty severe. I don't know if it would necessarily, by definition, mean the end of the alliance relationship, but I do believe that it would corrode some of the structures and of cooperation that currently exist.
Now, in South Korea, it's easy to find progressive groups that are, if not openly anti the Korea-U.S. alliance, at least highly skeptical of it. You just mentioned the possibility of conservative groups that might think that if they felt that they couldn't trust the U.S. to come through on its alliance commitments and may want to go nuclear. Are you aware of any groups on the conservative side of the spectrum in South Korean politics already who are skeptical of the alliance?
Well, I did find it interesting that at the time of the Yoon Suk-yeol state visit back in April, to sign the Washington Declaration, the nuclear consultative group establishment, we saw the Chosun Ilbo talking about how the U.S. was shackling South Korea to a non-nuclear commitment. And, you know, that strain of argument is precisely what I'm talking about. It's a little bit ironic because I don't think that most people necessarily might associate Chosun Ilbo with anti-Americanism.
Sure.
But, you know, on that particular policy issue, I think there is a very clear expression that there are limits, and that those limits may be driven by a sense of abandonment by the United States of South Korea.
To what extent is the mainstream within the Minju Democratic Party not in favor of or skeptical of or even against the alliance with the U.S.?
Well, that's an interesting question. I would say that in the Moon administration, what we saw was, in the end, a president who saw very clearly that it was in the interests of South Korea to maintain a close relationship with the United States. In fact, I was really struck in May of 2021 after Biden came into office.
Mm-hmm.
First joint statement that occurred between Moon and Biden got a lot of criticisms from conservatives.
In South Korea?
In South Korea, primarily because the conservatives doubted that the Moon administration was serious. They thought that the administration was just engaging in lip service. But mm-hmm. I don't think that that was the case. I think that the Moon administration, President Moon himself, recognized the value of the alliance in his head. But I do think that maybe in his heart and among some advisors who occupied senior levels of the administration, you know, they also wanted to move in a different direction. There is a strain of nationalism in South Korea that is based on the concept of shared brotherhood.
Mm-hmm. With North Korea.
Yeah, unity of the race.
Right.
And, you know, that is a strain of thought that does sometimes point to the U.S. as an obstacle, trying to block that unity. But, you know, I think that, you know, just recently with Kim Yo-jong's recent statement and her description
of
President Moon as a quote-unquote wicked man with honey in his mouth and a sword in his heart.
Yes.
It shows that North Koreans are not necessarily on the political spectrum integrated with South Korean progressives. They're a different breed.
Right. Before I go into that Kim Yo-jong statement, just a quick follow-up. How do you evaluate former President Moon Jae-in's ability to walk that tightrope between what he felt in his heart and what he realized in his head?
I look pretty closely at the Trump-Moon period, and I think that President Moon actually did succeed to a fair degree in managing President Trump.
Mm-hmm.
I would say he was relatively successful. We saw a lot of tensions between the U.S. and some of its closest allies.
Yeah.
But, you know, President Moon, I think, took the measure of Trump, told him things that Trump liked to hear that also served President Moon's policy agenda. And that's the reason why President Moon and his administration were able to initially serve as an intermediary between Trump and Kim Jong-un. And then, of course, it soured. And as a result, Moon became marginalized. It's not that President Moon didn't have some skills that were particularly attuned to Trump's personality. It was really more that I think in the end, I think that what we realized is what I was just talking about with Kim Yo-jong, South Korean interests and North Korean interests didn't necessarily align.
Mm.
And so during that period, you know, I think the best example of that was the Moon administration's desire and insistence on trying to bring the United States along in making an end of war declaration.
Yeah.
And to some extent, that was portrayed as something that North Korea wanted. But I think that the more that Trump and Kim Jong-un interacted and the more that senior officials between the U.S. and North Korea interacted, the more it became clear that actually the North Koreans didn't really have much of an interest in the end of war declaration. They certainly didn't take any steps in the direction of helping to realize it. And so, again, I think it's just an evidence of the fact that South Korean progressives who are focused on North Korea of a certain generation, they may have had a vision of reconciliation with North Korea, but it never was truly shared by the North Korean leadership. I'll just add one more thing. What I would say, you know, about progressives in South Korea, I mean, that's a particular generational, I think, quality to focus North Korea, the brotherhood idea. You know, in some ways, I think that it's entirely imaginable that in the future we would see progressive leadership in South Korea that embraces the United States, but also pursues social policies that are more progressive and might be very welcomed by the broader South Korean public.
Now, turning to the recent statements by both Kim Jong-un and Kim Yo-jong in the last 2 weeks, there are some people who say that, well, this is a sign that North Korea is finally turning away from its vision since Kim Il-sung, since 1948, of unifying the Korean Peninsula. But there are others who say that actually it may simply be a continuation of North Korea's long-term strategy to drive a wedge between South Korea and the United States and to effectively weaken or break up the alliance and get South Korea on its own. What's your feeling on that?
Well, I actually think that when I read those statements and when I see the takeaways from those statements, for instance, the designation of South Korea as the main enemy, it feels a lot like tit-for-tat reaction.
Mm.
It really expresses something about the psychology of the North Korean view of the direction and tone of the leadership in the South. And it's something that they don't necessarily like. I'm reluctant to suggest. I think that the best wedge driving strategy that the North Korean leadership currently has is really related to continuing its nuclear program as a way of demonstrating the failure of U.S. efforts to try to achieve denuclearization.
Mm.
Because that's part of what has fed, I think, South Korean public support for gaining its own nuclear capabilities. And so in that respect, I think that the debate within South Korea itself about nuclear sovereignty is one that the North Koreans are very glad to see and would mm-hmm. like to feed and provide energy for.
Right. This last week, I've been looking at some of the news coming out of Taiwan with the Taiwanese presidential election coming up, and lots of stories mention China's efforts to influence electoral politics in Taiwan by basically saying, don't vote for this guy, he's pro-war, and vote for these people instead. Is North Korea perhaps, with these statements by Kim Jong-un and Kim Yo-jong, taking a leaf out of China's playbook and trying to influence South Korean domestic policy that way?
It's entirely possible that the volume has been turned up on some of those statements precisely because North Korea is aware that there is a South Korean election on the horizon. I mean, we're very familiar for decades with the bukpung, the North Wind, the yes. idea that North Korea is going to try to influence South Korean politics. I think for the most part, North Korea has been pretty ineffective in pursuing that strategy. But one thing that I did do in the book was to try to look in a more detailed way at North Korean influence operations in South Korea.
Mm-hmm.
And I did that by examining a constitutional court case from the mid-2010s involving a decision by the court to authorize the dissolution of the United Progressive Party at that time.
Led by Lee Seok-gi, who went to jail.
He went to jail, but I think what's notable is how the court grappled with that kind of reasoning.
Mm.
It was basically because of statements that Lee was making of incitement and direct advocacy of attacks on South Korean critical infrastructure. So that was incitement, and it also expressed, in some ways, what's interesting is the dilemma of a constitutional court having to grapple with the boundaries of free speech versus national security in a way that I think is distinct in South Korea, but also I think does have a certain resonance with some of the current court battles as related to January 6th. And so in that respect, I would say that the thing that I looked at in the book, the case that I looked at, was very much focused on specific North Korean influence as related to not actually disinformation, but incitement. And so I can't necessarily point to and don't have much evidence for foreign-led efforts at disinformation. It kind of seems like in the South Korean political environment, South Koreans are doing well enough on their own, generating homegrown disinformation in a fashion that is not dissimilar to what's happening in the United States. It's really the marriage of technology and fragmentation of the information environment that I think is a bigger threat on the U.S. and South Korean side. I don't know enough about all of the allegations related to China's efforts to spread disinformation in Taiwan.
Mm-hmm.
Tried to look a little bit at Chinese efforts to influence the South Korean domestic political environment, but I don't see... There are some cases, but they are not of a scale that I think is remotely close to what is being reported about efforts focused on Taiwan.
Yeah, it's well known, of course, that China is not happy about the U.S. ROK alliance and doesn't like to see it strengthened. course, it applied a lot of pressure on South Korea during the stationing of the THAAD battery back in 2016, 2017. Do you see a chance for China to be successful in bringing down the alliance?
Actually, quite the opposite at this moment. I think that China has yet to mount an effective counter strategy to deal with the alliance. It wants to impose some costs on the Yoon administration for shifting to an alignment with the United States. But I think that Chinese leaders have struggled to find ways to impose costs effectively.
Mm-hmm.
The main area that I think gets a lot of attention is really related to economic retaliation post-THAAD and the lessons that have been learned in South Korea and the United States from that. And of course, the governments currently are doing a lot to try to develop strategies for countering possible Chinese weaponization of economic interdependence or reversion to some kind of retaliation, economic retaliation. And we'd have to see what that would look like. But under current circumstances, you know, I think that the Chinese government actually maybe has a little bit less leverage, economic leverage against South Korea at this moment, because a lot of the measures that were imposed around 2017 have not yet been fully restored. If putting it is that, you know, Chinese tourism to South Korea last year was about half what it was pre-THAAD or pre-pandemic. And so the levers by which to impose pain on South Korea economically are simply not as strong as they used to be.
Now, North Korea always claims to be under threat of invasion by the South Korea-US alliance. Are these claims in good faith?
It's very clear that the North Korean leadership views the United States, I think, especially post-Hanoi failure, as hostile to North Korea. And I think that the biggest sticking point really lies with the continued U.S. single-minded insistence on denuclearization of North Korea. And of course, we see North Korean rhetoric around the evils of U.S. imperialism, especially in speeches at the United Nations. It's also reflected in a lot of the public media commentary. So I do believe that they feel that the U.S. is hostile. In some ways, I think that the failure, each successive failure that North Korea has had since the early 1990s in its efforts to reach out to the United States, I think have resulted in deeper and deeper North Korean feeling that the U.S. is simply not going to change direction, and that maybe reconciliation with the U.S. is actually unattainable on the terms that North Korea would desire to achieve it.
Now, Scott, you first came across my radar with your 1999 book, Negotiating on the Edge, North Korean Negotiating Behavior. Has your book written almost a quarter of a century ago stood the test of time? I mean, if you were writing a book about North Korean negotiating behavior today, what would you add, subtract, or take away?
That's a great question. I think that the book is out of date, but also I couldn't write a sequel because we don't have a record of interaction between the U.S. and North Korea. You know, that book was a book that I wrote by analyzing patterns of interaction between U.S. and North Korean diplomats, primarily through the lens of American officials' experiences in negotiating with North Korea. And, you know, really, if you think over the course of the past 15 years, it was only the summitry period in 2018 that could really generate many stories. And the duration of the interactions was not sufficient, I think, to provide any sort of pattern like the one that I explored in 1999.
Well, there was a six-party talks that that came after that.
Yeah, I said 2006, but I should have really said 2008. I mean, post six-party talks, I think that there's, and I actually did some various articles and short pieces, you know, analyzing North Korean negotiating behavior through that period.
Right.
But, you know, if I wanted to do the same thing today, I would only have, since 2008, we literally only have 2018.
Yeah.
You've got the summits and you've got a meeting in Stockholm and really, you know, almost nothing else. And I think that that really is testimony to the fact that, especially post-Bush administration, the North Koreans increasingly focused on recognition of its nuclear status as a goal and as a prerequisite for dialogue, whereas the U.S. continued to see denuclearization as the condition for dialogue. And another way of putting it that I was mentioning, especially around the Trump-Kim symmetry, is that at that time, you know, North Korea really wanted detente, not denuclearization. But the U.S. was looking for denuclearization in exchange for detente.
Yeah.
And that, I think, ultimately was the fundamental reason why Trump and Kim Jong-un misconnected.
Is there one major thing that you've learned about North Korea in the last quarter century that has caused you to seriously rethink earlier positions or beliefs about the country?
Well, I think North Korea definitely evolves. And I think that there is a certain, and I don't necessarily, I can't really put my finger on the underlying core of this, but it's pretty clear that the bureaucratic and leadership structure has shown a lot more resiliency than outside Western observers tend to give it credit for. And I don't know. I mean, I like to think that I am not necessarily bound by the caricature of positions that many, you know, have views of related to North Korea. I like to think that I wasn't necessarily taken in by that.
Yeah.
And that I tried essentially to do my analysis of North Korea based on the merits and be open to being disproved. But, you know, there is a sense in which, as one watches certain types of repetition, that there is something about the quality of the regime that one begins to see, then it makes it both resilient and not amenable to direct, really, that needs isolation, I guess. And so I think if I step back and think about that type of question, I think about the fact that, interestingly enough, both Kim Jong-il and Kim Jong-un tried to pursue economic reform on their own terms, but of course, within the limits of the need to sustain their own leadership in place and to sustain their own regime longevity and control. And they both ended up facing pressures for retrenchment. And so that cycle of failed reform followed by retrenchment that we saw in 2002 to 2008 under Kim Jong-il, and then I think really, you know, from the early 2010s to what followed the Hanoi summit in the case of Kim Jong-un, it really, I think, underscores the challenge, the leadership challenge of the inability to pursue full economic reform and integration with the outside world without risking the conditions that they feel are necessary to sustain the regime.
Now, you're soon to leave the Council on Foreign Relations and join the Korea Economic Institute of America. Why is that?
Well, it's a chance for me to do something a little bit different. You know, I've been doing research on U.S.-Korea relations, and at the Council, the focus is really on writing books. And I've had three authored or co-authored books come out over the course of the past 12 years. And this is a chance for me to kind of move into management and, in a way, I think maybe take a more active role in hopefully promoting understanding rather than necessarily doing the analysis underlying the relationship. And so that was appealing to me to try to really set an agenda for an institution and hopefully continue to contribute to the conversation, but more by enabling and directing the agenda rather than trying to fulfill it through my own research.
Now, I've heard it said by some that the Korea Economic Institute of America is closely influenced by South Korean domestic policy, and even that it is registered under the Foreign Agents Registration Act. What does that mean, and is that a fair assessment?
Well, it is registered under the Foreign Agents Registration Act because it is wholly funded by the Korean government through the Korea International Institute for Economic Policy. It is also registered in Washington as its own independent entity. But because the money is all coming from the Korean government, it registers. And so KEI, because of that, it registers. But we, and even though it's under the Foreign Agents Registration Act, KEI does not lobby. It simply was established to promote understanding between the U.S. and South Korea. And so, you know, I don't think that I would be very, by personality or attributes, I don't think I would be very good at lobbying. So it's a good thing I don't have to do that. But I do think that I can carry forward a mission focused on trying to continue to promote understanding between the U.S. and South Korea.
Mm-hmm.
And also, hopefully, you know, I've long conceived of one of my roles in the think tank community as trying to prevent train wrecks between the two sides.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was in a position to talk informally with policymakers on the U.S. side and with counterparts on the South Korean side in more frank venues and fashions than can possibly be fit into a set of official meetings.
Yeah.
And also, I have the benefit of having watched the relationship for a long time and kind of understanding the rhythm and the way that the relationship has evolved.
Mm.
And so that's really where I'm going to be trying to make my contribution, is in just promoting understanding and also hopefully helping to prevent train wrecks or to mitigate the impact of train wrecks, for instance, like the consequences of the Inflation Reduction Act and its reverberations. Mm. Relationship, that kind of thing.
Is there any final thought that you'd like to leave us with today, or a question that you wanted me to ask you but that I didn't?
Yeah, maybe I'll just take a moment to just underscore the fundamental argument in the book, because it's really related to the combination of domestic political polarization and the emergence of exclusive nationalism. And the part that I don't think that we talked about that much is really about the development of political polarization in South Korea. And so, you know, I'll just mention that one of the very striking moments for me that made me decide that I really wanted to explore this topic was back during the Moon administration, when we actually saw simultaneous public demonstrations involving large groups of people mm-hmm. on opposite sides gathering in two different parts of the city of Seoul.
Yeah.
And of course, South Korea's geography and its focus on Seoul is certainly not something that is replicable in the United States, but it really provided a visual representation for me, the reason why there was cause for concern about how those factors can interact in order to weaken the objectives and interests of South Korea and the U.S. respectively.
Right. Yes, I remember that there were some signs welcoming Kim Jong-un to visit Seoul, and then there were other signs that were calling for his execution.
Yeah, there's that. There's also, at that time, I think that the other galvanizing issue was the justice minister and his appointment. And of course, that gets you into, in a way, the origin story related to the current phase of Korean politics.
Right.
Yeah. Because President Yoon became a viable political candidate in the context of that environment.
It did, yeah. Well, I tell you, it's been fascinating talking to you today, Scott. We must end it there, unfortunately, but I thank you for coming on the NK News podcast. Listeners can look for your book, The United States-South Korea Alliance, Why It May Fail and Why It Must Not. And they can also follow you on Twitter at SnyderSAS. Thanks once again for coming on the show.
Thanks so much, Jacko. Really appreciate it.
And we hope to talk to you once again in the future when you're firmly ensconced at the KEI.
Okay, that would be great.
Keeping up with South Korea's fast-paced developments just got easier. Welcome to the Korea Pro podcast, your weekly briefing on the stories that matter. Hosts Jongmin Kim and John Lee dissect topics from diplomacy to technology, ensuring you're always informed. Our episodes are a must for professionals in and out of Seoul. Subscribe on your preferred platform and elevate your understanding of Korean affairs. Korea Pro podcast, where clarity meets depth. Ladies and gentlemen, that brings us to the end of our podcast episode for today. Our thanks go to Brian Betts and Alana Hill for facilitating this episode, and to our post-recording producer genius, Gabby Magnuson, who cuts out all the extraneous noises, awkward silences, bodily functions, and fixes the audio levels. Thank you, and listen again next time.